Hello, you're listening to a podcast of the Best Bits of Breakfasters with Mon, Bron and Daniel for this week ending Friday the 31st of July 2026. You can catch us live on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. broadcast on Wurundjeri country from Melbourne, Australia. Coming up on the pod this week, legendary award-winning playwright Joanna Murray-Smith has adapted Chekhov's Uncle Vanya and came in studio to talk to us all about that with Uncle Vanya himself, Daniel Henshaw.
And I ask the age-old question, is it a skirt or a bag? And the team go big with Andy Griffiths in to chat about his new book, You, Me and the Gigantic Knucklehead.
We turn a critical eye to creepy, cheapy, wearable tech, and Murray Cardi extols the new set of stories from Omar Musa, the vape lord of Queanbeyan. Triple R. Anton Chekhov's theatrical masterpiece, Uncle Vanya, has received the modern Joanna Murray-Smith treatment with her adaptation of the Ryan Wistful classic. It stars Daniel Henshaw in the title role. And to tell us about Uncle Vanya on Now at MTC, the friend of the show and prolific playwright and the award-winning actor, join us now. Joanna and Daniel, welcome to Breakfasters.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Of course, Uncle Vanya is universal, but I want to know how it's become a bit Australian.
How it's become Australian? Well, it's only become Australian in the sense that it has Australian actors in it and it's adapted by an Australian and it's designed by Australians. I mean, otherwise, the location for the play hasn't changed at all. And even the time period hasn't changed. So it's still set in Russia in the 1890s, but the language is contemporary. So the idea behind that was that I, first of all, I'm a little bit bored by updating to new times and places and now and setting an abattoir in, you know, 2026. So I was very excited about a naturalistic production because we don't get to see those beautiful, expensive productions much anymore. And to invite the audience into the real world of that landscape in that countryside. So Dan Barber has done the most incredible set, and but the language is very modern, so that for instance, because Uncle Vanya is so funny, comedy, the one thing that more historical language creates a problem for is comedy, because anytime you have this sort of sense of strain or being strenuous in the language or trying, you know, contrivance, somehow or other it takes the comedy out of it. So being in a colloquial modern-day language allows the play to be as funny as Chekhov intended it to be and as heartbreaking. I mean, it's called a heartbreaking comedy and for a good reason.
Yeah. And Daniel, is this are you getting a kick out of this?
Absolutely. No, the language is very accessible, so it makes it very easy to give over to an audience what is going on for each character. I think it's very relatable. And you know, some F-bombs are dropped, which makes
too many.
Too many, maybe.
Had a few complaints, I
think. Already?
Just through the previews. Was it fun to contemporize? Like, was there any lines where you're like, I've nailed that?
Super fun. Oh, every line. What are you talking about?
Every line is
No, it was very fun, but the reason why it was such a delight to adapt is because it's so modern. I mean, the play is written in the 1890s, but it feels as if it could have been written in 2026. I mean, the themes of the play really are people searching for the meaning of their existence. That is going on in our house every day with all five members of the family. And relationships and the yearning and the thwarted longings and, you know, the search for love and the ups and downs of that search. And thirdly, the environment. So, I mean, the stuff that Chekhov wrote in Astrov, the doctor character, who is a passionate environmentalist, although he's a doctor working in the countryside. You know, I can't tell you how many people came up to me on Saturday night and said to me, was that really in the original? Now, I didn't extend that at all. Like, Chekhov had that proportion of writing about the environment in the original. I just put it into contemporary language. So the foresight and the modernity of what Chekhov applies himself to in Uncle Vanya is there's no one who wouldn't relate to that play.
Mm. Uncle, he's 48 or 49?
47.
Mm. So that, when it was written, was kind of seen as...
That's
but
the
you
end.
Look 48 or 49.
Thank you.
You bring a certain depth to it.
Yeah, great.
But it's the that age, has that changed your interpretation of the character for what how a 47-year-old lives today, even though it's set back?
Well, I think it's intimated that 60 is sort of the end of your life. Like that's the lifespan.
Yeah, I should have cut that one.
I quite like it because people read into it, depending on the age of the audience, they read into it differently, I think. Like, there's a laugh or a gasp or a, like, how dare you? You know, which is great because it's, you know, but I think, like...
The poignancy of that, though, is
I
that
do
you
like
saying,
that.
How do I last that long?
Yes, how do I get from here to there?
Mm-hmm. How do I last that long when I'm
doing
so
this?
So frustrated and disappointed by myself and by life? Whereas most of us are clinging on to life, you know, sort of going, you know, how do I extend it? You know, I think that tells you a lot about the period and the difficulty of life at that time.
I think that's quite, like, it's relatable to now, right? Like, it's, you can be pent up for so long about something that you can't see until a certain person comes into your life and mirrors, like, as in the Sean McAuliffe character, Sobriar Coffee comes into the world of this family, like in-laws overstaying their welcome, and puts up the mirror to Vanya, and Vanya is just seeing his life that he hasn't lived, that he could have lived, and all that pent-up rage that you have for the thing that you didn't become that you thought you might become is now very evident, and I think that's quite true.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, yeah, that's right. You reach a peak moment, and that's what theatre is. You know, let's capture that moment where everything spills from moderation into extremity. That's you know, how playwrights live and function, is always looking for those moments. And that's what happens in Vanya. You know, Chekhov writes about this sort of ongoing situation, this sense of ennui, and this sense of people have been living their same daily lives day after day after day. And then what's special about the moment that this play is told, this story is told? Well, there's the arrival of this couple, and this couple finally trigger him into this sense of absolute outrage over both himself and at them and the world. I mean, Chekhov said something about, like, any idiot can deal with a crisis, but it's the day-to-day life that really kills us. And, you know, it's so true.
Mm. Mm. What about Daniel making Uncle Vanya lovable through his self-loathing?
Ooh.
He doesn't have to try.
Thank you. I'll take that. I think it's just like falling into that idea of not fulfilling one's potential, I think. And I think that's really like, if you have some sort of empathy, you understand that in your own experience. I think people can relate, even for the vastly horrible things that he says, you know, that he speaks of other people within the play behind their back and to their face. He does it with such joy and reverence. I think that's relatable too, that you wish you might be able to say those things. You know, when you have an argument and you go away and you're like, fuck, I wish I said, oh, sorry. Excuse me, listeners. You know, when you say that thing and you go, oh, I wish I could have said it like that.
That staircase wish.
He says it like that. You know, you know, and it's kind of really fun, and I guess people can relate to that in a good way. But I think it's the pain of realizing all these things, and you agree with him. I think even though he is verbose and potentially in an ugly way, because it comes from a sense of rage and how dare you, I didn't get what I need of myself, a selfish way perhaps. That you agree with the argument, and you agree with the thought process, and you agree with the unfairness perhaps. But people put him in his place. Don't get me wrong. That's fun too. You know, like, that's he gets a real good dose of accountability from the doctor, especially.
He does.
At his lowest point, which is great.
Yeah.
You know.
And the stagehands get a lot of busy work.
They do.
They
really do.
I mean, it's an incredible production. I mean, it's huge. I've got a photo on my fridge from opening night that they gave us of everybody involved, and it's like 100 people in this photo.
Awesome.
So from stagehands through to props builders, you know, and there's something really beautiful and quite appropriate about this play about labour and you know, this kind of world which involves so many people doing so many things. It's absolutely reflective of the process of theatre. You know, you've got, there's nothing more exciting as a playwright than arriving at the MTC and walking past the rehearsal room where all these guys are working, going straight out to the workshop and seeing these magnificent poplars being created with all these beautiful autumn leaves and this hot, huge space, like an aircraft hangar, is just full of trees. There are a cast of thousands who put this show together.
I noticed I was reading this version, the Penguin Classic version, and you'd punched up one of the Chekhov gags. You added 100 years.
Oh, did I?
Because I said, I wonder, you know, if people are 100 years in the future. And you flicked it to 200 and it works even better.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, which proves the universality and timelessness. Yeah.
Yes, and the amnesia of the adapter.
Yeah.
You can't remember what they've done.
You did a lot. You can't be forgiven for nothing.
But it is true. I mean, there's this sort of really poignant moment in the play where the two women are talking, who are both in love with Astrov the Doctor, and Yelena, the sort of adult, you know, very adult, sophisticated beauty, just says to Sonia, the young girl, you know, what sort of man thinks about what the world is going to be like in 200 years when he's dead? You know, and is sort of, all his hope is invested in a better life for future generations. And there's something just so moving about that, you know, as particularly in these Trumpian times, you know, where we're just dominated by figures who are thinking purely about their moment now in the sight of the world. And yet there are people behind the scenes quietly working away in so many different areas for a better life for the future, whether they're environmentalists or medical researchers or, you know, whatever. And I think that concept is so interesting. What is our life for?
Daniel, have you reflected on unrequited love and putting it all on the line and being florid in your declaration?
The beauty in what Vanya goes through is that I haven't ever expressed myself to the extent that he does, so it's really fun to be able to do that every night to someone that doesn't want it. And Kat Van Davies, who plays Yelena, is so beautiful and so charming and enigmatic. It kind of, it's really fun to play with. It is a desperate place to sit when you get to the point where you're so obviously telling someone that you want them, and they so obviously do not want you, and you still do not get the message. Perhaps if I say it this way, or if I explain it to this way, it'll make more sense this time. And you will relent.
There's something. Dan's ability to bring the fragile, vulnerable moments to Vanya is, you know, really extraordinary. And I just loved watching him in the rehearsal room, where, you know, it's something that a lot of male actors actually find quite hard, is to express their vulnerability in their characters. I've watched it in my plays over and over and over, and that part is very, very accessible to you.
Thank you.
You're a tender-hearted person. But honestly, the cast are all absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's a
and,
brilliant
you
ensemble.
Know, Philippa Northeast as Sonia is really a wonder to behold. And Annie Lu's direction has been very clever in highlighting Sonia's journey, because really, in a way, the play could be called the name of any of the characters in it. That really the story belongs to them all. Vanya is kind of the centre of the ennui and the angst, but they all have fascinating stories to tell. And so Sonia sort of begins the play and ends it, and she's absolutely amazing, this actress.
Yeah, Pip is incredible.
She is incredible.
We're fresh out of time. I do wonder if adapting this is, you feel like it's brought you closer to Chekhov, or even made you turned you into the writer closer to that you want to be or aspire to be.
Definitely. The writer I would be if I could be. Yes, I think
what a joke. And then, Daniel, obviously, you've got some rage in this, but it's a funny rage. But we know that your rage can be legitimately terrifying on screen as well. Are you going to swing in your next project to scratch another itch, do you think?
Oh, mate, I'd love to do anything given. You know, working's great. I'm happy to be here.
We're keeping him in the theatre. He's not going back to the screen.
Oh, well, it's such a beautiful show, and we're so lucky to have you both in the studio to talk to us about it.
Appreciate it.
Uncle Vanya is on now at MTC. Joanna Murray-Smith and Daniel Henshaw. Thanks heaps.
Thank you.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
I had a gig on the weekend run by Nat Harris, ex-breakfaster.
Friend
of the show. It was a comedy clothes swap. So there was a comedy show, and then after the show, everyone got to do a clothes swap. But part of the gig was you spoke about a piece of clothing. And I've brought in the piece.
You brought it here?
I brought it here. So for your benefit so you can see it.
That makes me think no one bought it.
No. Yeah. No one.
Why'd you bring it? Oh, that would look so fetching on you. Is that a miniskirt?
It's a wool miniskirt that has one giant pocket on the right-hand side. And this
maybe Peggy would wear it in Mad Men?
Maybe Peggy would wear it. Maybe a quirky kindergarten teacher.
Or Miss Lippy.
Someone who might say, I make my own earrings. that's who would wear this skirt.
Now,
and this is a skirt I own and
still own, despite trying to give it away.
Despite taking it to a clothes swap and trying to give it away for free. I've worn it one time. And
did you buy it?
I did buy it. The issue I have with this skirt is that I'm engaged to a woman, and that is, and mostly my style has been described to me as only woman that works at the cattle station. So it doesn't fit.
It's not practical.
That is not practical. No. I could not round up cattle in that. But the most embarrassing thing about this skirt is not that it was like a weird impulse buy or like a well-intentioned gift gone wrong. This is something I reverse image searched. I hunted this down. I had to have it.
Who was wearing it? What made you it want
was,
it?
Funnily enough, I was watching a TV show called Insecure. And the lead / writer / showrunner, Issa Rae, was in it. And she's a very cool, talented woman with 6 seasons of her own TV show. And I thought, that could be me.
Ah.
Maybe all I need is one giant pocket to turn it all around.
If I just had the right skirt.
You could really put in your own iPad in that pocket.
You could.
you could have
the whole script in there.
I reckon it actually is definitely big enough for a Kindle, if not a real book.
Oh, that a Kindle would be swimming in
That's
that.
True. It is iPad size. It's not even an exaggeration.
It's so insane.
I'm sad that you brought it in and didn't just wear it in today.
Oh, just, could Over you your imagine? Jeans. It is the kind of like, you know, sometimes you get a piece of clothing for what, I don't know what happens, but then you get it home and you're like, did I have a psychotic break?
Mm.
What happened? Like if I wore this out and about, people would be like, nice skirt. Do you not think there's nothing
happening?
Are you okay? Have you hit your head?
You could put it next to the fire extinguisher. Because it looks like you could toss that over a rager.
And put it out.
Yeah, and it'll snuff it out.
Yeah, it would. Or ignite.
It's wool, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's the lining might be a little bit more.
Yeah, maybe it's wool look.
Yeah, right.
Like cashmere feel. You know, so I remember when I was in Japan and you go into all the stores there and everything is so cool and they have like cool homewares and cool gadgets and a friend saying, just remember, you're going to go back to your house. And I was like, this is going to look bad in my house. I feel like you see that skirt on someone different or you see it on the rack and you're like, I could pull this off
This is incredible. It looks amazing. And then it's like, oh, there's nothing else in my wardrobe I could possibly wear with this.
So it's like wherever you go, there you are. And you look shit.
Where you look worse. You are, all your tastes are aspirational.
Yeah. Wherever you go, there you are, and now you're standing out. And everyone can see it and they can laugh at you. The one time I wore this was for a self-tape audition, and I got, and the role was for a Bridezilla character.
Mm.
And this was the straightest, angriest piece of clothing I owned.
Did you get the part?
I got the part. I got to be very mean to a dry cleaner. So,
well, great.
Dreams do come true.
Well, then keep it. You never know what other roles it could be suited for. But And you took it yesterday to the clothes swap.
I took it to, and I did, and then and at you, the end I said, oh, I'll leave this behind. And Nat said, oh, you just take it with you.
Please don't love me.
Please don't.
With that thick please fire blanket.
Bring down the clothes swap.
You know how janitors have, like, implausibly massive sets of keys? Mm-hmm. Like, you carry around
you
that.
Could. Oh. That could.
You could that's steal what it's the, made you for. Could steal the cafe toilet keys that they attach to, to like a pool chair.
Yeah. Secrete a plank of wood in a pouch like a Joey.
Designed for you never to forget. And I'm like, oh no, I put it in the giant pocket.
Well, it's feminist because you know we're always talking about how women's clothes don't have pockets. They're like, we'll give you the biggest pocket, and then all you hags can stop complaining. We gave you one big pocket.
It's a girl boss
She's got
pocket.
One big pocket. Imagine how many stones you can fit in it. You go right down. Someone on the text line suggested I put it on a statue in town somewhere.
Put it on a statue? Oh, yeah, covered that up. Oh, it's in just because.
I guess no one else wants it.
Hey, I might try it on.
You want it?
Yeah,
you
can maybe take we it. Can offer it to Joanna Murray Smith when
well,
she comes
Kylie's
in.
Well, Kylie's out in Burwood, isn't she? Deacon.
Oh, yeah, go
I could put it on Kylie.
Absolutely not, because that bum was crafted to perfection.
Just models cover it up like the Taliban.
Yeah, oh no. Did you buy anything? Did you come away with anything?
No. Well, you bring clothes and then you take some.
Oh, what did
just
you?
Swap.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no money. So, and then because no one wanted my skirt, I didn't take anything.
Oh, okay.
Does that mean that there was another piece that was left behind? Did many people have pieces left behind or was it just you?
No, lots of people. Well, mine wasn't left behind. I was told not to put it in the mix.
Oh, you couldn't even do it. You couldn't even
that's
offer
what,
it.
Yeah, and Nat was like, oh, that's okay.
God, it's not that bad. I've seen some of the shit Nat wears. No, I'm just kidding.
I know. I didn't think it was that bad either, but she was like, oh, keep it. And I was like, oh, okay. And,
no, keep it. It would look so good on your floor.
So back into the wardrobe it goes, but I don't know. There were leftover clothes, but they went to charity. So it wasn't even good enough for charity.
That's a line in Sound of Music. Really giving my filmography this morning. Where she says the poor, they're like, what happened to your dress? And she's like, the poor didn't want this one. So secondhand don't even want it.
Secondhand don't even want it. I mean, they weren't there. She didn't ask. Maybe I'll turn up.
What about you and Liz? Do you ever share clothes?
We share so many clothes, and now half of my wardrobe is having a European summer.
Oh.
And I can't wear my favourite pants now because they're.
Would
over
she
in
like
Europe.
To wear this fetching rust coloured number?
Liz?
Yeah. Mm.
Next time she's negotiating with Roger Sterling.
Every time we've moved house, she's like, please throw that out. And I'm like, no, but I wore it for that audition. Maybe it'll come in handy again.
Was it expensive?
Because
that would influence my decision. If I'd spent good money on it, I'd be like, I can't.
I actually can't remember how much it was, but it wasn't. It's somewhere in between. It's not like I spent $300 on the skirt.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's.
It also could be maybe a Commonwealth Games team outfit.
Oh, like an opening ceremony.
Yeah, opening ceremony.
It is, like, wear it with a blazer.
Yeah.
It is like the colour of the red dirt.
Some long socks.
A sunburnt country.
Now we're cooking.
With the Mambo shirt.
I love
it. Some of the Mambo
country.
Shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that would go perfectly.
Mm.
I should get in touch with the Australian Olympic Committee. Like, I got an idea for Brisbane.
What if we all dress the colour of sand?
What?
Desert sand. I wonder if you could weave this into a Triple R 50th birthday radiothon prize or like outfit.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes, well, I'm just thinking.
Should I wear it to the OB?
You should wear it. Yeah. Or, you know, we can auction it off.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I just think I've seen uglier clothes.
I don't think, yeah, it's not the worst skirt in the world. It just doesn't. Oh, turn it into a cool bag. Someone's okay. Just.
It's already got a cool bag in it.
It is
that
a cool
is
a, bag.
Some pocket.
It's a wearable bag.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Andy Griffiths is Australia's fastest and highest-selling author, current Australian Children's Laureate, vocal copyright campaigner and the foremost exponent of literary idiocy as writer of his beloved Bum series, The Just series, his Adventures Unlimited series and his New York Times best-selling partnership with Terry Denton, The Treehouse series. Andy's new book is You and Me and the Gigantic Knucklehead, and to tell us about it, new adventure book illustrated by Bill Hope, the perennial juvenile, joins us now. Andy, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Thank you very much.
What stupidity have you started here?
Well, I'm featuring one of the villain characters who has become very popular, called Johnny Knucklehead.
Mm.
And he literally has a knucklehead. He's like a Batman kind of harmless supervillain, like the Riddler or the Penguin. He has been trying to make gigantic animals for his burgeoning Hollywood movie monster career, but him and his brother Jimmy have an argument, and Jimmy pushes him into the vat of Grow Big Potion, and Johnny becomes a gigantic Johnny, who squashes his brother, steps on his brother, and is exiled to the land of the giants, where he becomes king. And that's where all our fun starts.
Yeah, and the giant, there's a helpful scale at the very back about the size of Johnny.
Yeah.
Bigger than the Eiffel Tower.
Way bigger than the Eiffel Tower, way bigger than anything we've ever imagined. And me and you, because you are the other character in this series, we stumble upon the scene of his exploded laboratory, and we step in the green liquid and we become giants as well.
Yeah.
And we start exploring all the things that you'd want to do as a giant, which is, you know, jump up and down and make earthquakes, take the clouds and see if they taste like fairy floss, use cars as skateboards. And the townsfolk, understandably, get a bit sick of this, and they tie us up Gulliver's travel style. And exile us to the land of giants. But we are not as big as the giants, so now we're mini people in the land of giants. Mm-hmm. So I'm having my cake and eating it too.
Yes.
Exploring little people in a gigantic world and gigantic people in a little world.
Yeah. Do you have a mate that you go on adventures with, or are all your adventures kind of internal and imaginary at this point?
I'm a book-based adventurer. Look, I've done a lot of bushwalking and that kind of expeditions in the real world. Which has taught me endurance, which is one of the things you need most as a writer, is the ability to endure long sessions of editing, of reworking, and just getting it right.
Yeah.
These days it is book-based adventuring, and that's what I'm always telling the kids. You know, books are an adventure. You open that cover, they can take you anywhere. And they're not always pleasant places, and they're often mind-blowing places, but that's the pleasure, not knowing.
Where do you get, I'm not saying where do you get your ideas from, but is there a primary place for creative epiphanies? Like, do you go on bushwalks with a notepad, for instance, or is there somewhere that's reliably inspiring for you?
There's a deadline is reliably inspiring. And I know I have one every year, so I know I have to be constantly monitoring for ideas. Music is a huge source of inspiration, always has been. The electricity of an exciting song like the one we just played, Slap Your Mammy, is like, I want to take that, makes me excited, and I want to translate that energy into my fiction. So that's always been important. And, of course, other books. So in this book, I'm drawing on Gulliver's Travels. That degree in literature has finally... well, it's paid off many times.
Yeah.
The book before this, we fell down a hole and discovered the peanut butter beast. Johnny Knucklehead dragged it up to the surface, where it goes out of control, King Kong style. Mm. So, I'm often using classical texts to I'm stealing,
put the pill in the dog food.
I'm adapting classical texts for young kids.
What about it seems like a consequential time to be Australian children's laureate in this age of AI writing and the copyright concerns. You must think about this a fair bit.
Absolutely. And I was up recently in Canberra lobbying the government to hold firm on copyright and to resist the pressure that big tech is putting on the Australian government to water down copyright, to give them an exemption so they can mine all the data, including novels, music, art, film. They need to feed this into the machines to train them to become more sophisticated. And in America, they've already been going to pirating book sites and just taking them all. So there's a lot of, there's 100 court cases going on in America, class actions. It's not the case here because we have copyright law, strong copyright law. If you create something that's yours to sell, and by agreement with the person, and you can give them a license. They were trying to get the Albanese government to say, come on, this is where AI will invest a lot of money in data centres if you just cut us a break here. And to their credit, they have held firm and said, no, copyright is what you create as an artist is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have to negotiate with us.
Goodness.
Do you feel safe or you still think it's an ongoing, obviously it's an ongoing battle?
It's an ongoing battle, and there are all the other issues with AI, including the environmental effects of data centres, and also the fact that they can... You could probably put in your parameters and say, give me an Andy Griffiths book, make it 300 pages, make it funny, exciting, and you'll get a crappy book out of it. But nevertheless, it you could go and sell it as my book. So I believe Amazon.com have put a limit on people uploading more than 3 novels per day to their self-publishing kind of ebook section.
Oh.
So people are just spitting crazy books out. So the market will be flooded with AI imitated novels, or already music. And I think if it's labelled as such, we can't do much about it. But I don't think AI is about to replace true human creativity and originality. Machines can copy, but I don't believe they can create something out of nothing, which is what a good piece of music or a book or a film does.
Speaking of something that's difficult to replicate, this might be the first book where I've got a magnifying glass out to read some of the text.
Which part is
well,
that?
there's illustrated. I think maybe there's people throwing out insults, and the text gradually gets smaller. And, you know, you're circling page numbers as well. Normally I would have thought page numbers were like an inviolable sacred part of a book, but you're mucking around.
No, they were during the Just series, Just Annoying, Just Tricking, Terry Denton made an entire saga out of the page numbers. It would be a fish and it'd be complaining, oh, I have to put this page number, and they get them wrong and then all this other stuff. So... yeah, everything's up for grabs in a book because it's a game and there's no rules. And I'm very aware that I'm messing with the reader's mind. And the more, luckily with kids who have plenty of time for play and messing around, they love having their minds messed with. And I think that gives them permission then to go, oh, you can do anything, and that's where the creativity is. Triggered.
Yeah. Do you find silliness every day?
Yes, you have to. And you might, here's an exclusive for you, you might see parallels between Johnny Knucklehead and a certain US president. because when Knucklehead becomes the king of giant land, he enslaves the population to make donuts for him. Because he wants 10 million donuts a day, and he becomes a tyrannical, out of control, crazy man. So I can see I'm taking the events of the last a long time, and they are getting into the books.
Is that the only way you can sanely deal with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, reality is outstripping comedy at the moment, if you're keeping up with what's going on in the US. But, yeah, there's fun every day, and being around kids teaches you that. And even as an adult, if you're reading with kids, or you can be reconnecting with your inner child. So, and the fun thing about You and Me is that that's the name of the characters. And if you're reading to a child, then you become me and the child is you. Or if the child is reading to you, they become me and you become you stay as you. So I'm really enjoying that because all the kids wanted to be in the books. That's how this happened. They said, can you put me in your next book? And I thought, well, I can't put
it's a good catch-all.
Millions of kids, but I can call you you. And so these are adventures that we've had, and I'm reminding you of all these because you've conveniently forgotten. Oh, you remember? You remember when we became giants? No? Well, let me tell you a story.
You're famously fit, really. You're a good runner. You haven't stopped doing that. I'm wondering, plugging into... I've never seen so many donuts in a book, and treats and lollies. How do you stay tapped into that?
Well, I mean, it's not an effort to stay tapped into liking donuts. That's fairly easy. The difficult thing is resisting eating them morning, noon and night. But that's what they do in the book. And so a book is an outlet to explore that. But in the treehouse, Andy and Terry are living on a diet of lemonade and popcorn and everything wrong. And I did start to feel guilty. And the fourth book in that is the 52-story treehouse where their publisher is kidnapped by vegetables who are angry that the publisher has published a vegetarian cooking book. And so he puts the publisher in a big cannibal's pot. And we have to rescue the publisher because we can't write the book unless he's yelling at us to write the book. We get caught by vegetables and we're rescued by the author of that book, of the vegetarian book called Vegetable Patty. And she comes in with her knives and her mashers and she cuts and slices and dices and then turns to the reader and says, that's why I need you to eat your vegetables. Eat your vegetables before they eat you. So I have my conscience is clear. I have put a pro vegetable eating message into my book.
And to this day, kids are having nightmares about vegetables, right?
Yeah, well, that's not my problem. I was just trying to get them to eat the vegetable. To my knowledge, no one has taken that message.
All right. Well, we got to get out of here. Where are you off to next in your either in your children's laureate endeavours or in your fiction writing?
Well, there's in children's laureate terms, I'm doing events in every state and territory over this year, large family events, and I love getting hundreds of people in there, young and old, to just enjoy all the silliness and promote books. The next book, we're going underwater. We have I love deep sea fish and all that nightmarish quality of those things. So, yeah, we're going to go on an underwater odyssey.
Beautiful.
Buzzword of the day.
Well, yeah. You and me and the gigantic knucklehead is the new book. And it must have been fun to have an idea like, well, what would a knucklehead look like? And
well, this is the fun thing about collaborating and working with Bill. I said, what does this character look like? He gave me three kind of droogy-looking, idiotic-looking characters, but the fourth one had literally a knucklehead. And went, that guy.
Here we are. Love it. Well, to enjoy all of that, you've got to buy the book. It's out by Pam Macmillan.
That's correct.
All right. Yep, Andy Griffiths, you and me and the gigantic knucklehead. Thanks so much, Andy, for coming back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Woo!
That's right. Triple R.
Everyone by now is surely across the Meta glasses, which are like Mark Zuckerberg's glasses with the cameras in them. We here at Breakfast is all huge fans because we're all massive pervs. Can't get enough of them.
Well, Daniel is a glasses wearer and his eyesight is fine.
That's right.
But the Meta glasses, right, so they start at $469 Australian dollars to get a pair. And you might be sitting at home and you might just think, oh, I can't afford to make women uncomfortable. Have I got news for you? Kmart have got you covered. What? Anko have just released
what?
Their own version. There's an $89 pair of Anko camera glasses you can now get.
Which is, great.
Yeah, great. It's good.
For the everyman.
For the every, yeah,
for the those, every perv.
For those salt of the earth pervs.
Do you have to like carry the cloud around with you?
Yes.
At least an external hard drive plugged into the glass.
Vacuum cord.
They will catch fire on your face. Yeah. Fingers crossed. No, but yeah, the Meta glasses you can at least hide behind. They've got other functions. Like you'd be like, actually, I use them to translate stuff. Oh. Whatever. Mm. The Anko glasses, absolutely not. They are photo, video, and no light to tell you what they're on.
Oh, that's illegal.
Mm. Is it?
Well, yeah. It should I mean, be. They're Meta, they had to change it. I'm pretty sure. Well, anyway, if it's on sale in Australia, that's it. Are they on sale in Australia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. So they're here, you can get them at Kmart and Target. Get along.
Oh, well, our premier worked at Sound and Vision in Kmart.
This is his bag.
Yeah.
Yeah. He should be wearing a pair in Parliament.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, that's a tenuous link to business.
Well, I blame Labor. Oh, there'll be a Dave Hughes video about it tomorrow. But I mean, Meta have got Kylie Jenner. The Kylie Jenner version are $600-700.
Yeah.
The cool girl ones. But I don't know who would you get?
Oh, to model style. Well, Ben Carroll, obviously.
Ben Carroll in the Anko glasses. The ex maths contestant. I mean, that would be
because famously, Parliament has cameras. Like, state Parliament only has one camera, and it's conveniently on. Well, maybe it's changed, but it was locked on the government. So if the opposition leader had a worse angle. And so you, from the gallery. And so, but if they're all wearing glasses, it'd be more like sport.
Like the ref video during the World Cup.
Yeah, body cam.
From the dispatch box.
Does that mean the opposition could just be like flipping them the bird and stuff while they're making their speech? Get busted. There is, I mean, I have watched, I don't know if you said, I forget what this guy's name is, but he's on like TikTok, Instagram, where he makes videos where he goes into struggling like mom and pop restaurants, eats their food, makes it like wearing the glasses, says, has a little chat to them and then puts that up and then these restaurants kick off and they get a bunch of business. And it's very sweet. It's all very wholesome and sweet. But when you do watch them, no one ever clocks it, which is interesting.
On the people,
yeah,
in the
like
room.
The people he's chatting to, are never like, hey, what is that a camera in your eyes? Just, yeah, why are those glasses huge?
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't really know what they look like on. Like, I've just seen the Kylie, Kylie Jenner. I've just seen like her ads, and obviously, in a, you know, doing all weird kind of poses. But I don't know how weird they look when someone is wearing them. I don't think I can.
Maybe someone's already been filming you.
Well, that's, like I said, it's Daniel.
Well, it is 2020 over here.
I mean, it's going to get to that. Like, I'm just not going to trust anyone wearing glasses.
Yeah, I was thinking that when you talk about the Parliament thing, I was like, is it going to be a case where, you know, when you go into somewhere, they have to, you've got to get your glasses scanned, check them at the camera, are they safe, put them back on?
Well, if it's already gotten to the point where Anko are pumping out a pair, there must, like, it's going to get to the point where they're going to make them so well that you're not going to have a clue.
If you can get
someone's
them,
got.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you can get them from Kmart.
Next to a bag of banana lollies. Then we're all doomed. I wonder what the quality of photos is on those ones. That's what I'm concerned about.
The pixels. Quality. Oh, the pixels. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. If someone is taking photos of me in the bathroom, I would like them.
I want them high res.
HD.
Well, they look, they're pretty thick, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty thick. Yeah. I would say like a Rolf Harris type glass.
Mm.
Well, that tracks. <it? laughs>
Also could be one of their models.
Or the. Yeah,
he would have loved these.
Eugene Levy.
Aww. Yeah, they've got a Eugene Levy about them.
Okay.
He would, he's.
If you want to look like that. It's just the Kmart Eugene Levy. Yeah. So
if you
the dad and the guy
that guy.
Fucks the pie. The American pie.
Remember him? No, he's great.
Yeah, but the dad of the now the dad's got video footage of the baby son fucking the pie. And that's what you want.
I mean, there were people.
The mangled pie.
People will buy them. It'll be fine. Like, there's like, oh, there's a backlash. It'll be fine. They'll sell them. People will be a bit angry.
Will.
Nothing will happen. And then there'll be kids at school. It'll be kids. Kids will be wearing them. You can't be on. They can't be on their phones or whatever, but then they'll be getting around the playground. They'll go to the staff room. And I'll film the teachers.
Eugene Levy's on the monkey bars.
They're going to egg the teachers on.
Yeah, they'll do. Yeah, they will. And then And then the kids are going to send this footage to make a complaint. Other teachers, that's it. They should strike again, actually, about this in anticipation.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I'm scared for what this could mean for everybody.
So if they're connected for music and hands-free calls, how does that work?
Oh, they've just got Bluetooth in them.
So does that mean you...
It'd have to be loud.
Out of the speaker on your eyes?
Got to be so obnoxious. You're just walking down the street blaring a call.
I mean, people walk down down the street having calls on speakerphone already because everyone's an idiot.
I can't... How you do that without being so embarrassed?
Yeah, there's no shame. Again, we've said it before, bring shame back in 2026.
But so,
I've got it all recorded.
That's it.
And actually, we do need to diversify our social media in Triple R. So you can subscribe to our glasses feed.
Yeah, exactly.
Got us on TikTok, Instagram, glasses.
They're at that community radio price now. We can do it.
That's right. Actually, the glasses are cheaper than a full subscription. Oh, we could do a package deal.
Send them out.
Yeah, or is this just the new? Did people freak out when cameras were first introduced on phones? Probably. Did they? I mean, I'm not pro this. I just want to put that out there. I'm not saying.
I don't remember there being a freak out. No. I remember it being a novelty because also they were bad.
Oh, they were so bad.
They were so bad, and you know, you can see when someone's holding a camera up. A phone up in your face.
Yeah.
Is it Socrates? He always gets dragged out. Like, who's Socrates talking about teenagers?
Socrates talking about camera phones.
So when anything absolutely dire happens, it's like, things just change. They evolve. And, you know, it's maybe upskirting is not good. It's just natural.
Hey. Upskirting with the glow, you're like lying back on a skateboard.
Actually, that's the thing. These cameras...
Dad's been lying back in the park a lot.
Socrates' glasses actually are terrible for the upskirting community.
Yeah, wait till they get the cameras in the toes of the shoes.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Yes, indeed. How exciting. Rick Hardy's back.
I'm not going to bore you with my dreams, but I am going to start with I feel quite elated this morning because every now and then I have dreams that a really famous, handsome man is madly in love with me. And last night it was Ryan Gosling.
Congratulations. Nice.
He couldn't live without me. But just to temper that, the night before I passed JD Vance.
Okay.
Right? I know, bad. Mm. And I remember thinking, they're not all romantic dreams, but the last couple of nights. And I remember thinking, I've got to make a go of this. I don't know why. And he stuck his tongue in my mouth, JD Vance, and it was like a big slug and he didn't move. And I was like, this is disgusting. So I wonder if I was like eating my pillow or chewing on my mouth guard or something. My imagination swept away with me. It's the good with the bad. Anyway, how are you all?
Actually worse now if I haven't heard that.
I'm sorry. But every now and then when I wonder if my subconscious is going, are you okay? I'll give you a little treat.
And then you get a Ryan Gosling.
And it's always like Taika Waititi going, I can't live without you. And you're like, stop. Please don't. I can't. So I feel in like very good spirits this morning.
Oh, what about JD Vance's beard? Where's that come on? Is that like way down on the list of concerns?
Well, in pashing, I have pashed men with beards before.
Yeah,
it's not an issue.
The beard was I was just trying to work around that big fat tongue. It was really gross. It was really vivid dream. I woke up quite unsettled. And I'm a vivid dreamer. So, you know, obviously the emotions of the dream carry with me to the day, which is why I'm like,
still going to talk. You've got to get the chest.
Yes.
Well, and his new book is a big hit.
Ryan Gosling.
No.
I know who you're talking about. I was trying to change the subject. I don't want to read that book.
Yeah.
We did Hillbilly Elegy for the book show, and I think it got quite a good response.
Mm-hmm.
But if that guy, I would say, I'm not interested in. Come on, let's stay in the Gosling mode.
No, you brought up the slug tongue, and that's all we're thinking about.
I was really trying to, and I don't know why I was going, I'm going to give this a good go. Like, I had good intentions.
You don't know what led to the kiss?
I was cooking a lot of different dishes. Don't start asking about my subconscious. It's a twisted
place. It up.
Oh, no, I don't. That's true. But the thing is, I realize now I don't give myself much downtime to process things in the day. It's pretty much consistent information. So it's, you know, and I do meditate at the start of every day. But then it's like news, reading books, listening to podcasts, writing, blah, blah. And then when I go to bed, my subconscious goes, you're going to sit down and you're going to process everything that happened in this day. And so then the adventure begins. I'm not talking about books yet, am I? Okay. But I am going to talk about Omar Musa's The Vape Lord of Queanbeyan. You guys know Omar, obviously. So Omar is a poet and a spoken word performer. Now, I took my friend Cristiano to see some modern dance. And at the end, I said, what did you think? And he said, dance isn't really my alphabet. Now, he's Italian and English is his second language. But that phrase has really stuck with me because some things are just not your alphabet. And poetry is not my alphabet. I kind of like, you know, when you're walking around a weird piece of art, trying to look at it from different angles, that's what poetry is like for me. Mm. I'm like, I don't understand. Why are you talking like this at me? I'm like, wow, just talk normally. But every now and then a poet cuts through. And Omar Musa is a poet who, and this is a book of short stories. Mary Carr is another poet who wrote a nonfiction memoir trilogy, which started with The Liars Club, which is a really beautiful book. And sometimes when poets write fiction, I go, oh, poetry. Mm. And when I see Omar perform, I go, oh, poetry. Mm-hmm. And Joel Maher as well from TZU is a beautiful spoken word performer. When you kind of get it, the alphabet kind of gets into place and then you see someone else doing it. You don't get it. Anyway, Omar's got a quite specific voice. He grew up in Queanbeyan, so he's got the juice on Queanbeyan. But this is a book where the short stories are set globally. There's one in Bosnia, there's one in Borneo, there's a lot in Canberra. But it's a kind of really global book written in an Australian masculine voice. Omar, you know, he grew up in a pretty rough neighbourhood and there's really elements of kind of all of that in there, but there are talking lizards. There's a lot of magic realism. Don't let that put you off if that scares you. It's a very, very human, beautiful book. And weirdly, why have I put a book in that's so hard to describe? But it is very hard to describe.
Mm. Well, did he perform something from this book at the opening of the Melbourne Writers Festival?
Yes, he did. Were you there that night?
Yeah.
Isn't he amazing?
Yeah, it was fun.
And he actually, that's a really interesting programming thing. And I talked to Veronica from Melbourne Writers Festival about it because he's incredible. When you see him live and he does this kind of spoken word and everyone's in his thrall, and she put him on first. And I remember sitting there as like a curator going, I want to put him on first. Mm. Who's going to follow that guy? And then the next two people were amazing.
Yeah.
So, but I remember thinking, I'm going to run first. But yeah, he did perform something from this book. It's really, it's interesting. It's very masculine. And I do read a lot of men to my discredit. But I realised because I'm going to give a postscript mention to another book in a minute. You didn't say I could do that, but I'm going to do that. But, you know, I've got the whole genre of books that I grew up with, which is drunk, old, white, annoying men. You know, like when you start reading Bukowski and then you read like Martin Amis and Kingsley Amis and I'm like, I love them. They're so problematic. Oh, apparently Bill Oddie is not a nice person.
Oh, well, he's just dying, isn't he?
I know, I thought, you know.
Oh, trampling all over that.
Stick the boot in there.
Well, because I loved him.
Well, you missed the train, can't cancel him now.
No, or can I? No, but I posted a picture of him on Instagram and then my friend went, you know, he was a terrible person. I was like, but you can't trust anyone.
Can you trust your friend, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh. I mean,
how does your friend know?
She's from the UK.
A little birdie
told her. Oh, I like that. Mm. It was that. What do you call it? I was about to say flitting. What do you call it? Flotting. What? Looking at birds.
Oh, twitching.
Thank you.
Flotting.
I had some of the words in there. I just wasn't sure. I mean, I can always separate the art from the artist. Mm. So Funky Gibbon will always be close to my heart. And also, every time I get told a male artist is problematic, I'm like, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's
yeah, probably.
Your base.
You should just assume they all are. Mm.
Sorry, I have to have a
And what a bonus if they're not.
And what a pleasant surprise.
And Omar.
Yes.
No, we won't talk about something else. What else did your friends say?
No, and I've seen Omar perform with his wonderful wife, who is a classical cellist, and I don't know if I'm selling these stories. Short stories are really hard to get the landing right. We often expect a lot of short stories because they do have to contain so much in a short period of time. And he does one of the stories in this book is a beautiful story about Islamophobia of a New York musician who makes his way up into the elite circles of New York and gets into such a problematic space in terms of wearing a keffiyeh and in his Instagram photos. And the story ends with with visual lino cuts in the middle of the book because clearly there's no space for this story to end, so he takes it to a visual space. Mm-hmm. So he does really extraordinary things with the form, which are beautiful and mystical and admirable, and the way that he finds the voice of these really different characters. Like I said, he gets inside, you know, Malaysian women and hip-hop artists and vape lords of Queanbeyan.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that...
It's the opening story.
Is there humour? Is it
yeah, it's a funny really, title. I mean, look, it's a... There's humour in the humanity of it, I think. Mm. It's not... I wouldn't bill it as a funny book, but it's a thoughtful book and a soft book and a wry book and just a spiky book. And to have the scope to go to such broad places and be in so many voices is a big swing that not everyone can make. And he makes it really deftly. Mm. He gets you inside these heads and you're not going, oh, I don't know if I should be here and I don't know if you can do this. He just feels like he's such an extraordinary talent. It's a really beautiful book that is of the earth but not of this earth, if that makes sense.
Oh,
am I allowed to do my postscript yet?
Yeah, okay, two for one.
Yeah. So the only reason I wanted to mention this, apart from problematic drunk white men, is who I love, is because the joy of reading it all, but also doing this with you three, which I'm so grateful for and I love so much, is that you read a book and then you go down a little rabbit hole that teaches you more about the world. So last time I was here, I did Nigel Planer's memoir, which is fine. But then that led me down a Young Ones rabbit hole. And, of course, I've been watching old Young Ones. Oh, my God, the muscle memory in that, the lines that I remember. Mm. And I don't think I've seen it since I was a kid. Mm. And it's just in there. You're sort of singing along with the words. Anyway, it took me down Aid Edmondson on Desert Island Discs and then Rick Mayall and reading about Rick Mayall. And then, of course, there's a documentary about him that's just come out. And then about Rick Mayall and Stephen Fry in the play Cellmates, which Stephen Fry had the classic, had the breakdown and walked out from. And because of that, I realised that the director and writer of that play where Stephen Fry had the breakdown wrote a book about the making of that play called Fat Chance. So I found it in a secondhand book online store, ordered it, read it, loved it. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, that playwright's really interesting, Simon Gray. So I bought his book. There's like, you know those booksellers online that are like, this copy's $5 at someone's house and it's got pencil marks in it. And you're like, hell yeah. So I've ordered his book. It's called An Unnatural Pursuit and Other Pieces. And it's all about writing plays and him. The foreword is by Harold Pinter. Whatever, just Harold Pinter. But having just had a play on and to be in this world of this writer who is dead and was like, oh, I've just drank half a bottle of whiskey and finished my latest play, like, you know.
So is it a memoir? Is it like a craft
book? It's
not
a memoir. I mean, this first, the one, An Unnatural Pursuit, is about his play, A Natural Pursuit, and it's a journal of the moment he finishes the first draft of the play to the moment it opens. So he's covering it, and I think he's dictating it day to day is what the experience was. He's just given it to Harold to read. He's very anxious about that. So, of course, he goes to a long champagne lunch because it's like 1982 and that's what you do when you're anxious about meeting Harold Pinter about your play. But having, like, my play closed last Saturday.
Congratulations,
by the way. Thank you. It was such a joyous experience. Oh, like, incredible. I really feel it snow-doming in my body. Like, it was such a exquisite, torturous, beautiful, difficult, challenging, mind-expanding, world-expanding experience. And so now that my body is slowly kind of healing from it, to be reading another playwright going on that journey is such a gift. And I wouldn't have found it if I didn't read Nigel Planer's memoir for this show.
Love that. Oh,
wow. You know, rabbit holes are so fun.
Truly.
And they teach you about yourself and the world. Like, I think all the art we reach for, and it can be in songs or in film or in theatre or in books, ultimately, whether we know it or not, we're trying to learn something about ourselves, whether we see ourselves mirrored in the pages or on the stage or in the song, like breakup songs. And but even if it looks like a cookbook, it might be something because you need to read a life story before you read the freaking recipe. But I do think all art, we're slowly reaching for a version of ourselves or something that will help us navigate the complexity of the world. And so thank you for Nigel Planer leading me to something that is going to teach me about the experience I just had putting on Losing Face.
Beautiful. Oh, well, it's testament to your curiosity as well.
Thank you.
Now, the Vape Lord of Queanbeyan. Yes. That's Omar Moose's book. That's out via Penguin. You also mentioned the Rick Mayall documentary. That's Lord of Misrule, I think.
No, no, it's called A Complete Bastard. I think it is. Rightio. It's just come out, and I can't hack BBC iPlayer just yet. Not that I do that because that's illegal. But if I did, I would have watched it already.
And then Simon Gray's?
Fat Chance is Simon Gray's book about the making of Cellmates with Stephen Fry having the breakdown. And Rick Mayall, who just seemed like such a beautiful, sensitive man, being left behind. It's amazing. And then the book I'm reading is An Unnatural Pursuit and Other Pieces.
Beautiful work, Marie Cardi. Thanks for everything.
Woo!
Triple R.
Thanks for listening to the Best Bits of Breakfasters. Catch us live on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. or listen on demand at rrr.org.au or on the Triple R app. You can get in touch with us via Instagram, Facebook or the Triple R website.